Peter B. Collins with news and comment. It is Thursday, February 7th, 2013. Code Pink gets the party started for John Brennan's confirmation hearings. The Senate Intelligence Committee convened today with Dianne Feinstein, California Senator, at the chair to hear the commentary from John Brennan and his response to questions from members of the panel. But the early portions of the hearing were interrupted repeatedly 5 times by Code Pink and other protesters who talked about the victims of drone strikes directed by John Brennan in his current job at the White House. And ultimately, Senator Feinstein ordered the room cleared and said explicitly that members of Code Pink were not invited to return. But I want to commend Medea Benjamin, and I saw my good friend, Colonel Ann Wright, one of the first people ejected from the room. I appreciate their speaking truth to power, as this is a rubber stamp process. It's very clear John Brennan is going to be confirmed as the next director of the CIA. The issue is what will be on the record in these hearings. And the White House conceded to Senator Ron Wyden and 8 others who had written a letter demanding that they get to see the secret memo that authorized the drone strike killing of Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen in 2011. The memo, by the way, was written after the fact. At least that's the clear impression we get from the white paper extracted from the lengthier memo. Now, so far, we're not anywhere near to full disclosure. The White House is offering to let members of the intelligence committees of the House and Senate see this memorandum. Well, ultimately, the president may have to yield further. We shall see. But in the meantime, Brennan offered up some interesting and contradictory comments as he seeks confirmation. And Senator Feinstein surprised the room by saying that she is going to introduce legislation to set up a new kill court. I'm sure it'll have a happier name than that, but she wants to pattern it after the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that has rubber-stamped all but a handful of thousands of requests that have come before it to wiretap individuals in violation of the Fourth Amendment and American law. And so Feinstein seems to think that putting the veneer of a judicial process on this autocratic power claimed by the administration and claimed exclusively to the executive branch, as we discussed at length 2 days ago when the 16-page memo was released by NBC News. And so it's going to be very interesting here to see. But I don't expect any further accountability, and I don't expect substantially more disclosure about the way the White House selects targets, the alleged process, the validity of the information, it's hardly evidence, that is used to determine who gets killed. And Brennan, in his written statement and some of his early remarks, said that he thinks, number one, the CIA shouldn't be involved in these strikes. He wants to see the military handle it. Now, that's fascinating and both, you know, humorous and infuriating. Because in his final weeks at the White House, we're told that John Brennan has been working on the rule book, the so-called playbook, for these targeted killings. And as he exits the White House to move to the CIA, in putting together this playbook, he is responsible for rules that exempt the CIA from the playbook. So what he tells the Senate Intelligence Committee is really immaterial. It is actions that we will have to monitor, and so far, those actions don't give us any encouragement that John Brennan will curb the use of drone strikes and the targeted killing through this illegal, unconstitutional process that we only know the outlines of. Now, in response to questions from Saxby Chambliss, the right-wing nut from Georgia who, I'm grateful, has announced he is going to end his service after this term, Brennan told him, "I never believe it's better to kill a terrorist than to detain him." Huh? Why didn't they offer a way for Anwar al-Awlaki to surrender? Why didn't they attempt to capture him? And while Brennan says he doesn't think the CIA should be in the detention business, he says that capturing people gives you the opportunity to collect intelligence, maybe through torture. And he went out of his way to say that he didn't approve of the torture program under his boss George Tenet during the Bush administration, and that he privately expressed his concerns. Isn't that sweet? He also said that the drone strikes are conducted in full compliance with the law. Huh? That we apply rigorous standards and a rigorous process of review. Consequently, he said, "I do not believe additional legislation along these lines is necessary. No, the courts and the Congress should just stay out of it. Only the executive branch can make these determinations." That's what we're being told. And this is what leads me to claim that what we're seeing is serial dictatorship in this country. I don't think Obama will attempt to serve a third term, or to change the rules or somehow to stay after this four-year term expires. But we have seen presidents expand the scope of power that they have unilaterally, arbitrarily, and we're not going to get it back. Now, I have an ongoing conflict with a local conservative columnist. She's the token conservative in the San Francisco Chronicle, Deborah J. Saunders. But I have to concede her point. She's a longtime defender of John Yoo, the guy who wrote the torture memos under Bush that were released in the early months of the Obama administration in 2009. And she says, you know, John Yoo took a lot of heat from liberals over enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding. But she says, quoting John Yoo, "What's the greater deprivation of liberties? Using enhanced interrogation techniques, waterboarding, or incinerating?" And I have to concede her point. Now, they claim that only three al-Qaeda detainees were waterboarded. I don't believe that. We know that the other torture tactics were used widely. But torture does not deprive people of, ultimately, their lives. Although there is one case of, at least we know, of a detainee who was tortured to death. And we do have a double standard. And it's liberals, progressives, Democrats, who have been silent in the face of Obama's expansion of power and the right to kill people. And as we discussed the other day, this memo that we've only seen the abstract of is really insulting. And it claims these sweeping powers without review, without checks and balances. And I think it's shameful that so many Democratic leaders suck it up and play politics over a really fundamental constitutional issue that we will live with for many years to come. At the end of this podcast, I'm going to feed you the audio from the lead segment on Jon Stewart's Daily Show on Wednesday night. Stewart said a lot of the same things I did about the terminology and the way this memo expands definitions to the point that they're meaningless. He says, they redefine imminent threat in the geological sense. And if you didn't get to see it, you'll hear the audio at the end of this clip, and you can find a link to The Daily Show's website in the show file at peterbcollins.com if you want to see it complete with the pictures. The Guardian newspaper in Britain identifies today the malfeasance of the American media. They've been sitting on a story for over a year about the secret drone base in Saudi Arabia that was the base where the drones were launched to kill Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son in a second attack. They've known about it for at least a year. And at the request of the administration, they did not publish it. The New York Times made the decision, and the Washington Post followed, to disclose this information just in advance of the Brennan hearings. I would bet that a top dog reporter has a book coming out on this that would have made their secrecy moot anyway. That's what happened with the wiretapping program and the knowledge that was sat upon even with the presidential election looming in 2004. Also on Capitol Hill today, Leon Panetta and General Martin Dempsey, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, were before the Armed Services Committee of the Senate, dodging questions about Benghazi. There's still more confusion there than information. But the interesting thing is that Panetta acknowledged that he joined with David Petraeus, then the director of the CIA, and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton last year, in advising the White House to arm the rebels in Syria. But because the president was in the middle of his reelection campaign, he put them off, and then Petraeus sexed out, and then Hillary fell down, go boom, had a concussion, and so the plan was never activated. I think it's very dangerous to arm rebels. We are seeing the blowback in Northern Africa from arming the rebels in Libya. And of course, that Libyan blowback, to my knowledge, was not raised nor discussed by outgoing Defense Secretary Panetta. In New York yesterday, a very important hearing that garnered zero coverage in the corporate media. And my source for the hearing related to the appeal of the lawsuit brought by Chris Hedges, Dan Ellsberg, and other plaintiffs, managed by Carl Mayer and Bruce Afran. It's one of the most important constitutional issues before us right now. But the corporate media thinks you're not interested. Or it doesn't matter, or maybe both. My report is based on the first-person account of Kevin Gostola. He's been on our program before. He's a young journalist and blogger. You can find him at firedoglake.com. And tomorrow, we have an interview scheduled with Carl Mayer that we'll release immediately on Friday. And perhaps you'll get to listen to it on Friday or over the weekend. But once again, the Justice Department is arguing in an inconsistent manner. Issues that they didn't raise at the trial court level, they're now trying to insert on into the record in the appeals process. Represented by Robert M. Loeb, L-O-E-B, the Justice Department, claimed that the plaintiffs in the suit have to demonstrate injury or active injury. They have to show that they've been locked up by the military before they can challenge this draconian unconstitutional act. And he argued that the NDEAA exempts citizens and doesn't apply to the conduct of journalists. But his colleagues were unwilling to assert that, despite repeated requests from the trial court judge, Catherine Forrest, and she noted that in her blistering ruling that was issued last September 12th. And get this, the government spoke about having now a decade of experience in detaining people and said no U.S. citizens or journalists have been detained. Well, not quite, Mr. Loeb. There's the case in Yemen of a man named Shea, and he's not Irish, a journalist who has been kept in prison at the orders of President Obama. We know the case of Jose Padilla, the American citizen, who was accused of terrorism charges, held at the Navy brig in Charleston for years under Gitmo kinds of conditions, is considered to have lost his mind, and took a plea bargain to charges that really didn't have anything to do with the original case that was alleged against him. So here, the Justice Department flatly lied to the appeals court. Also under discussion, the terminology of substantial support for a terrorist group. The plaintiffs argue it's vague, undefined. Judge Forrest largely agreed. And the appeals court panel, three of them, asked a lot of tough questions of Loeb. And one was kind of snarky. They were trying to get him to state the origins of the language about substantial support. He said, well, you know, since 9/11, it came into play. And they said, well, no, tell us exactly when and where is it in the law? He said, well, it dates back to before 2004. And Judge Lewis Kaplan interjected, in the same sense that we all date back to Adam and Eve? So we'll get more commentary on this from Carl Mayer. When it was his turn to speak, he dedicated his remarks to the Korematsus, who were interned as Japanese Americans during World War II. One of the issues, again, that we'll air out with Carl Mayer in our conversation tomorrow, is the extent to which the detention language in the NDAA duplicates other laws. And therefore, if it's unconstitutional, are the other laws unconstitutional as well? More fodder for scandal in the case of Senator Menendez of New Jersey that we've been covering here. The Washington Post reports today that he's been accused of overbilling the government's Medicare program by almost $9 million for care at his eye clinic in South Florida. We're talking about Salomon Meglin, the friend and political patron of Senator Menendez. Now it turns out Menendez initiated contact to the federal agency that administers Medicare and Medicaid billing. And it's clear that while he tried to avoid a replication of the Keating Five, those were the senators, including John McCain and the late Alan Cranston of California, who intervened with regulators and suggested they back off from Charlie Keating's saving and loan scams. And that's what Menendez did, but his staff claims that he did not specifically cite his buddy Melgen or Meglin's problems. I'm sorry, it is Melgen. I mispronounced his name. And interestingly, the Washington Post does acknowledge the two trips that Menendez took to the Dominican Republic with Melgen, but doesn't mention the role of prostitutes and perhaps underage ones in their party plans. In Chicago, Jesse Jackson Jr. is negotiating with federal authorities over a plea deal that could include Jesse Jr. serving significant time in federal prison. Now, I was under the impression that all this was related to his attempt to respond to Rod Blagojevich's offer of Obama's Senate seat back in 2009 in exchange for $1 million in campaign cash. Jesse Jr. said, sure, I can do that. But it turns out that the issue is a little more mundane, and it involves use of Jesse Jackson Jr.'s congressional campaign money to pay his wife, Sandy, who has a separate scandal or investigation underway into her financing of campaigns for an alderman job that she held in the city of Chicago and that she recently abruptly resigned from. And apparently, one of the issues is that Sandy Jackson got $5,000 a month from Jesse Jr.'s campaign fund for being a campaign consultant, even when Jesse Jr. was in a mental health facility and didn't campaign and wasn't even showing up for work. We'll follow this one, but could be a real problem for the Jackson family. And now briefly to the conflict points around the world right now. Rebels have attacked in Damascus, and the conflict there continues unabated. Efforts by the UN and others to broker talks continue to fail. In Tunisia, where the opening round of the so-called Arab Spring took place more than 2 years ago, the government is in very shaky condition following the assassination of a prominent leftist opposition leader. The government, which is described as Islamic, is now offering to hold new elections, but the opponents apparently have rejected that. They want the Islamists out entirely, from what I can glean. And in Mali, French Prime Minister Hollande showed up last weekend to congratulate French troops on the liberation of Timbuktu, but fortunately, he didn't claim mission accomplished. And it seems that the rebels do have more to offer the French occupying force there, and that conflict will continue for some time. Now let's listen to the audio track from John Stewart's take on Obama's powers to kill suspects, including American citizens, in countries that we're not at war with. And as I said, he does a brilliant job and is funnier than me in explaining what is wrong with this picture.
Let's begin tonight with the war on terror. You know, every now and again a report comes out that we killed Al-Qaeda's number three guy for the fifth time from above with a missiled robot plane, or that we missed him and mistakenly hit a factory that makes civilians. Well, you might wonder, is that okay?
NBC News has obtained a government document that lays out the legal argument to justify the president's use of drones to kill Al-Qaeda suspects, including, in some cases, U.S. citizens.
Wait, U.S. what now? U.S. who? U.S. citizens? Wait, I knew we were firing missiles at terrorists, but I never thought some of the terrorists could also be people on America's Got Talent. I mean, that's... You have to be American to be on America's Got Talent, don't you? You can't just... Otherwise, it'd be... Cuba's Got Talent. It'd be a whole different thing. I bet this leaked document's pretty specific about when the administration can order this kind of killing.
The killing is allowed if they're leaders of Al-Qaeda or an associated terror group.
Then no worries. They're not going to kill you unless you're part of the Al-Qaeda incorporated family, either the parent company or one of its many subsidiaries. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Libya, Euro-Al-Qaeda, Chipotle. Oh, really? They're not part of... I thought Al-Qaeda bought that from McDonald's. Didn't they? No? Well, either way, it's delicious. Look, lest you worry that we're being too general about who we can target and it's too late for you to cancel your incredibly ill-advised spring break trip to the Yemen sandals, the leaked document lays out clear limitations of when terrorists can be targeted.
We only take these kinds of actions when there's an imminent threat.
Imminent threat. By definition, that would require clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future.
An imminent threat does not require the United States to have clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future.
Really? Because that seems like if you did that, you would almost have to create a different definition for the word imminent. A broader concept, if you will.
They use the phrase broader concept of imminence.
So imminent threat, in other words, imminent or not imminent. Broadly speaking, imminent in the geological sense. So wait, let me just... We can kill an American who is an Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda adjacent if they pose an imminent danger, and by imminent we mean eventual, seeing as what you get to do is somewhat loosely defined here. I imagine the admissions process to determine who will be accepted into our for lack of a better term, Sky Miles program, is somewhat stringent, including perhaps your due process, your courts, your trials, your oversight.
Without due process, no court, no charges, no trial, and relatively little oversight.
So it's more of an open admissions process, is what you're saying. Before we do it, do we at least yell four? Heads up? You know, this is freaking me out a little bit. I mean, I'm just getting bits and pieces of this leaked information about our drone policy. If you don't mind, I'd like to see the rest of the memos. And I know the administration will show the pertinent documents to us because we have their record on such touchy global war on terror disclosures to go by.
The Justice Department has released the Bush administration memos that authorize the CIA to use harsh interrogation methods against suspected terrorists.
President Obama personally approved releasing these memos in such detail.
Personally! In fact, he invited everyone to his memo release party. That's his invitation. Although, ironically, guest list was classified. Now listen. We know how this administration feels about the executive branch withholding sensitive memos from Congress because of this 2004 discussion on these torture memos.
Will you provide those to the committee?
No, I will not.
General, that means you may be in contempt of Congress then. You are not allowed under our Constitution not to answer our questions. And that ain't constitutional.
By the way, that's also the name of his one-man off-Broadway show. Ain't constitutional. Don't you think he should have tagged that with, that ain't constitutional, So I think that answers the question of whether the Obama-Biden White House will release the memos detailing in specifics our drone strike policy.
Will President Obama release those memos?
I just have nothing for you on, alleged memos regarding potentially classified matters. Without going into the alleged existence of any particular memo or action, I can say that, you know, what we cannot do is discuss classified operations.
Alleged memo? Did you just go Jedi mind trick on us?
These are not the drones you're looking for.
But tell you something, Carney, you're good, but you're no Sith Lord.
Yes, Master.
I don't know what's worse, the alarmingly ambiguous guidelines for our drone strike program, or the fact that you're saying we might not have written these alarmingly ambiguous guidelines down in memo form, because I'm pretty sure the Justice Department has memos on this.
There are legal memos that were written by the Justice Department on this kind of killing, just as there were legal memos written under the Bush administration about the use of torture.
Ooh, that's gotta hurt. Although obviously a Democratic administration's White House secret war policy memos are very different from the Bush administration's secret war policy memos in that I assume the Democrats have written them on recycled paper. You know, they're very responsible environmentally, that's what I'm saying. So what were the Obama administration's reasons for letting the Bush torture memos out?
The truth is that because these were in the public domain...
Memo releasing precedent number one, public domain. It's okay to make material public when everybody already knows about it, and we're covered there because the New York Times released this U.S. memo on drone strikes, so we're good. Release them. What else?
Because even the last administration has revealed the most serious aspects of this.
Precedent number two, the administration has already fessed up to doing it, and Obama's done everything short of taking out a billboard about our drone program, so I think we're okay there, too. I think we're doing pretty good. What's the last reason?
And because the president has banned these techniques, there was no legal rationale for keeping them classified.
Oh. So we don't mind you knowing about the we do.
Once we don't do it anymore.
We're happy to share irrelevant information with the public. We told you we were going to be transparent. We just didn't tell you it was going to be about the last guy's secrets.
Thank you, John Stewart. And thank you for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins News and Comment Podcast. Your comments are always welcome.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.